listeners have been attuned to Big Picture Science episode Born Legacy. If you'd like to hear more Big Picture Science, you'll find episodes in our archive at bigpicturescience.org.
And if you're a podcast listener but prefer listening to over-the-air radio because you don't like to put on those earbuds and be in an internet bubble, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station's not on that list, consider letting them know you like this show.
And to reach us directly with your comments, throw in some faint praise and email it all to bigpicturescience@seti.org.
You hear me okay? No, you don't hear anything? You don't hear anything?
Loud and clear down here.
What the hell's going on with this interphone system today?
Yeah, and you too can be dancing with Daddy G every Tuesday afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Malt Shop, right here on WHFR.FM. The jukebox will be spinning the platters from the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and join me, Daddy G, at the Malt Shop on Tuesdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Be there or be square.
Are Tigers Cubs Troop 1151, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn.
This is Murdoch from the Pedal to the Metal Show, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. What do you get when you take a bunch of public radio nerds and shut them in a room with computer geeks? Well, in addition to some bizarrely socially awkward offspring, you get the Public Radio Player. It's a new iPhone app that streams hundreds of public radio stations, including this one, straight to your iPhone and iPod Touch. You can get more information at publicradioplayer.org.
Welcome and thank you for joining Impact. Today we will meet Michigan State University journalist Amy Hammerl. Amy and her husband Carl bought a historic house for $35,000 and started the adventure of restoring it and fixing it up. Or to quote Amy, well, our wonderful contractors had that pleasure of fixing it up. During the rebuilding, she reflects, I know a fair amount about urban renewal and rural property. In the end, it cost the Hammerls $400,000 to rebuild a house and find a home and a new community. The following is pre-recorded and does not reflect the views or the opinions of WHFR staff or Henry Ford College and staff.
I'm Amy Hammerl. I am a newly appointed professor of journalism at Michigan State University. I'm also a freelance writer. Mm-hmm. I cover entrepreneurship and small business for Fortune and the New York Times, mm-hmm. and recently wrote my first memoir, Detroit Hustle.
Okay, very good. Now, Amy and I were discussing as how she came about writing the book, and you were saying that the publishers were really more interested, were interested in having a personal interest type of a book or nonfiction.
Exactly.
Okay. You're a journalist.
I am.
So is there a difference between trying to write like this and do your journalism?
Surely. So as a journalist, I'm used to having that sort of distance between myself and the source. It's my job to, as I tell my students, to be the good, the truth, and the light, to go and, you know, be the voice for the voiceless, right mm-hmm. wrongs, investigate government, but you don't usually put yourself and your stories into it. It's about mm-hmm. other people. Mm-hmm. And so I suddenly had to turn that lens onto myself. And it was difficult at times to figure out how to write with clarity and with transparency and with honesty about sometimes things that were confusing or difficult and figure out what it meant. That was interesting.
All right. And I didn't get a chance to read the entire book, but I got 2/3 through the way. And as I was saying earlier, it started off like a biography, which is kind of, how she got into writing the book. But in some of the publishing editorial notes or things about it, I'm not using the right terms, where people are giving a lead into the book. Okay, mm-hmm. I can't get the right terminology yet. But they were saying how there was a distinct memoir, and I'm still going, okay, memoir things. But if you're reading the book, that is your personal telling, right, of your experience is very much what keeps a person reading.
Right. So for me, I had to actually go to the library and check out a book on how to write memoir, because I'd never done it before. My mom always told me you can do anything with a library card. So yes. I went and got my book. And I learned, I'd read a lot of memoirs. I'm interested in people's personal stories. So I was familiar with the form, but I had to learn that it's not just a tick tock, this happened, then that happened.
Yes, yes.
It's got to be sort of an exploration of ideas and themes and sort of a come to a deeper understanding by the end of the book. And I didn't know what my themes were at the beginning. I just didn't.
Okay, that was one of the things I was going to ask you, because and one of the things I liked, because I'm a native Detroiter, was the fact that you didn't try to gloss it over, and you also brought out a lot of truth.
Thank you.
In things. And one of the ones that stand out to mind is the quote from Coleman Young, mm-hmm, about, hit the road 8 miles, but then you gave the pool quote,
right,
which I may later on read to our audience. But that was the thing that kept me going in the book. And I also, I don't mean this in a negative way. I mean, it was like a hopscotch, but I think that that was what gave the true, it was like gave character and also gave, like, you were connecting with a person. It wasn't a lecture.
I tried.
and like I said, because I was one of those doubtful entry leaders, readers and stuff. And I think that that was one of the interesting things for me, is that, a lot of times you lead these lead-ins from the joint. This is a memoir, this, that, yada, yada. I'm going, yeah, sure, right. I'm one of those. I'm positive, but I got a little pessimism in the back of me. But that was one of the very interesting things about the book. And the I had a whole list of questions here that I was going to.
I think one of the things that was interesting in writing it is trying to keep two audiences in mind, which was, one, the home audience, Detroit, mm-hmm, and trying to write a book for Detroiters that wouldn't get me murdered in the street. I mean, we Detroiters, they're real people and they'll let you know what they think. And so the depth that they need versus a book for a national audience that may know very little about Detroit other than ruin porn and blight, and trying,
yes,
to,
yes,
manage those two very different interest and information levels and get enough to get people the basics, but not so in depth that you lose them. That was interesting.
Yes, and I have people who get opportunity to read the book. The way you do that, I thought was very, I like the way you do it.
Thank
I
like you.
The way you did it. Because, you get the things, you're talking to someone who's having conversation with you about the city. The book does, in my opinion, and this is my editorializing, the flavor of the book, and I use those terminologies, was that you got the impression of a person who was going through and identifying with it. Another part of, I think there was one page where you were talking about where you're going to a particular restaurant that was like 10 miles up Gratiot.
Right, up at Capers.
Right, right, right. And you described the drive from where you lived on the Van Dyke Place, mm-hmm, going up Gratiot, and what you would see. Could you share some of that with the audience?
Right. So, part of that book, part of that section of the book is really thinking about issues of race and class and gentrification and what my area of Detroit, which is the West Village, which is very gracious right next to Indian Village, mm-hmm, has mostly not been touched by blight.
Right.
But as I go up Gratiot and I'm trying to sort of put the city in context for myself and readers, sort of seeing just the bombed out and the decay happening and having to watch, actually seeing shadows of people in some of those buildings, mm-hmm, and sort of recognizing and talking about the 7.2 square mile golden bubble, as I talk about it, of downtown and midtown where things are happening, but the further you get out, being reminded that people are living in desperate situations.
Right.
And that being really important to me, and to make sure the reader saw both sides of that, and also really difficult to write about without making it sound like I was saying that was all that there was to Detroit, but also acknowledging that this is a complicated city with complicated narratives, and we have to face that nuance.
Right, and I think also as you describe, as you describe the different aspects of Detroit, that is pretty much what the city is. It is a hopscotch, this little oasis is,
right.
And they kind of like, you hop from one place to the other, you jump 7 miles this way, northwest, southwest, and then that type of thing. Now, are you in your home now?
We are.
Okay.
So we spent about 6 months. We had a temporary apartment while we were just trying to get heating, plumbing, water, because when we bought it didn't have any of those things. We had to redo the roof. The south wall was collapsing. So it was a pile of bricks with character, and that's about it. So after 6 months, we were able to move in and live in one room. Mm-hmm. And then we did about another 18 months of construction living like that.
Mm-hmm. Early, as you start up, you describe what you saw when you your first sight, okay, of this. Because Matilda, that's the name of your home.
My husband named her Matilda after the Tom Waits song, yes.
All right. Describe again for, just little snippets of when you first saw the house that you were now in.
So when we first saw it, it's this big, it's a Georgian revival, which I didn't know what that meant. It's basically just a square brick box, roof with dormers. It's, very lovely, 3,000 square foot, but obviously sagging. And it looks like the lady in the Tom Waits song. Like, right. She's seen some better days.
Right, right.
We go inside and we can barely see anything because the windows are all missing and boarded over. So it's very musty and dark and just sort of, dust motes and occasional streams of light peeking in. And trying to sort of see the bones of this house.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing we really find is there wasn't like a sink, there wasn't a refrigerator, there's nothing left. The only thing we found was an office chair and a bottle of Mountain Dew that was not filled with Mountain Dew. I'll just leave it at that. And sort of there had been a raccoon living in there.
Right.
So as we walk upstairs, there we have more light and we can sort of see a little bit more. But even there, the what would become the guest bedroom, there's a giant hole in the in the floor. In the bathroom, it's completely gone, and where the tub was a giant hole to the basement. Mm-hmm. So it required a lot of imagination to see what it could be, but both my husband and I felt touched by this house. We walk outside, and it's sort of, starting to be dusk, and this gentleman from across the street comes over, and he's like, "Hello, I'm Jim Boyle."
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of like, oh goodness. And his, he's like, what is your intention?
Mm-hmm. And like the neighborhood watch?
The neighborhood watch. He was coming over because he had been dealing with the house for 10 years vacant.
Right.
With an investor in Florida who just basically abandoned it. So the neighbors had been cutting the grass. They'd been boarding it up. They'd been trying to keep it from becoming, an eyesore, but it's a losing battle.
You know,
the house empty that long. And my husband and I kind of are looking at the house, and as dusk is coming on, a streetlight turns on. And we know enough at that time in 2013 to know, like, a streetlight isn't a given.
Yes.
And then this giant white tomcat walks across the roof.
Right.
And we look at Jim and we say, we're here to, we want to live here. We want to rebuild this house. Like, this isn't, he's like, "So you're not trying to invest in it or flip it?" And we were like, "No." He's like, "It's okay. You can do this. My wife and I did this 15 years ago. The neighborhood will help."
Okay. All right. All right. And was that part of the, not only was the neighborhood watching the property, but it was also, you were like a community?
That was the huge selling point of the house. We'd seen some others that were smaller, both in square footage and in project, and had kind of walked away from them because we thought they were too big of a project. And now here we are embarking on one even crazier.
All right. Now, there was also a part where you gave the history of the house. Okay. Can you share with us about the history of the house?
So as soon as we decided we were going to buy it and move forward, the neighbors started coming just sort of from everywhere, emailing and calling and telling us about Arthur and Nona Herzog, who had owned the house, from the 50s, 60s, 70s. Nona, finally left in the 2000s, so they had been there a long time. The neighbors knew them. And Arthur used to write for Billie Holiday.
Right.
He wrote God Bless the Child with Billie Holiday, and he was friends with Nina Simone. He was a PR, movie, music guy who'd moved from New York City to Detroit in the 30s or 40s, and sort of like had his office in the Fox Theater and lived the like crazy downtown life. And his son has told me so many stories of like him coming to Detroit to visit his dad and walking from the Fox to their hotel.
Right, right.
But he meets Nona and they get married and they move into this house. And so every time he would do a dinner party, he had a typewriter that actually typed in script.
Okay.
And he would type the list of guests and the menu and then put them in a book.
All right.
And so those books still exist at his daughter-in-law's house out on Long Island. And they've offered to let me see them. But apparently they are filled with just like the who's who of Motown and jazz and the movies of that era, because they would come through that house.
Right.
And Nona was a model. She studied at Sorbonne. She was from London and moved here after the Second World War. But just sort of apparently loved roses and peonies. So the neighbors just keep coming over and telling us all these snippets and their stories of the house. Apparently, Arthur liked to wear white linen jumpsuits with a kerchief. And so he met everybody at the door with a cocktail in his jumpsuit. And so it just really felt like we were connected to this history.
Okay.
And Arthur's granddaughter, Amy Herzog, is actually a playwright who was a finalist for the Pulitzer.
All right.
And so it was me as a writer and my husband as a jazz pianist. The serendipity of this house seemed really important.
And I know you've been going on book tours, you know, promoting your book, that type of thing. What are some of the questions that people ask you as you are, you know, about the book and what the reactions have been?
So usually people want to know, you know, why Detroit, which, you know, and sometimes that's of true interest and sometimes that based on stereotypes of not believing Detroit can be anything. And so I just tell them, like, really the community, the house, the people are what drew us to Detroit over any other city we looked at. They want to know, you know, why this house, again, the serendipity of the community.
Right.
And they, like we talked about, they want to know, you know, why I wrote a book. And why I wrote a book was really started out as just sort of the story of this house. And then I realized it was me grappling with where I come from, coming from sort of rural poverty. So being able to understand the poverty of the city, but not quite like, you know, rural and urban poverty are very different, but sort of that putting me in a mindset to realize and sort of accept like, I'm rising up on the class ladder and have had that fortune while my family is falling back down at home.
Right.
And so they want to understand a lot about that. They want to know what Detroit's like right now, which is so hard to talk about.
It is.
You know, because so many great things are happening and wanting to embrace that and talk about the new restaurants and the new buildings going up and the new energy. And also recognizing and having to acknowledge 40% poverty, people who can't afford to pay their water bills. What are we doing about jobs creation for those who are here? Jobs training, not just looking at the city's future being my husband and I. If the city's future is just based on newcomers like my husband and I coming here, this won't work. We have to address the population.
Right, right. Do you feel that you are a Detroiter now?
I do.
And how so?
So I realized when I was out on book tour, somebody actually asked me from the audience, they said, you refer to Detroit as an us and a we. And I realized at that point that I had to sort of internalize Detroit, partially because, you know, my husband and I are here. We're not leaving. It's not a fix and flip the house and go somewhere else.
Right.
This is where we're building our home. And I feel like an us. And a lot of the book is, and I realize a lot of my life has been grappling with who's an us and who's a them.
Right.
Who's a local and who's not. I come from a very small town, and small towns are really friendly, but they can also be a little standoffish until you've earned your way in.
Yes.
And so Detroit, I feel like, is very much the same way. It's not a New York City where people expect some anonymity. It's a place where you're expected to say hello, greet your neighbors, know, and be watching. And I love that about Detroit. And so it was really when my neighbors started talking to me as a Detroiter and saying, you're one of us, that I realized I felt like I'd earned my way in. But it's a lifetime of doing that. It's not a one moment. It continues on forever.
Right. That, and I think anyone who has grown up in Detroit and go outside, one of the things, and as another Detroiter, is that we're not the usual city.
No.
Okay.
Which is fabulous.
Excuse me. But, and that comes across, is that anyone who deals with tourists, whatever, when they when you say Detroit, they start treating you totally different because we're not the stereotypical the city type. It's a combination of, because Detroit, you know, is, I used the word earlier about hopscotching, we have so many different types of communities, you know, and it's growth, and that's something else that you bring out in your book, about how Detroit grew you know, it's part of his history of how it expanded so quickly and so fast and incorporated such a large area. I guess the closest that for people to understand that would be maybe a California type experience of being spread out and everybody had a car.
Right. I mean, my home city is Denver. And so one of the things that became really interesting to me writing this book is that people talk about Detroit and its landmass just being too big to manage with the population it has. They say that you can fit a San Francisco, Boston, and Manhattan all in the landmass of Detroit, which is true. You can also fit it in the landmass of Denver.
Right.
Denver's 132 square miles compared to Detroit's 139. Mm-hmm. We have 700,000 residents. Denver has 650,000 residents.
Mm-hmm.
Guess who has the boomingest economy in the country right now? Denver.
Right.
And so I'm really interested, like, you know, we are spread out, but other cities have seen success and are seeing success, especially with the introduction and sort of build out of public transportation, the light rail line.
Right.
So I feel like those are some, for me, sort of writing the book, those were interesting corollaries to be looking at.
Right. And as you were talking earlier, I remembering, because back in the day, I'm about to age myself, the area that's called Midtown now was the ghetto, it was not necessarily the ghetto, but it was like the down and out area.
Right.
Okay. And now it's similar to where you are is because, you know, also something else you point out in your book is how, many of the homeless or slum people, this is like during the World War II era. That's when the Cass Quarter became the down-and-out area around the campus. And so you had those who couldn't, you know, a lot of the derelicts, the homeless, that type, were down. And now is Midtown, and those mansions are now being renovated and that type of thing. Is there a collaborative effort that you have experienced from those different hopscotch areas? You know, you said West Village, which is right next to you. Midtown, are there interactions between those communities or...
You know, I think there are. One of the things I've really liked is the Community Development Corporation. Mm-hmm. So like the Grandmont Rosedale CDC is incredibly active in the villages, which incorporate sort of Island View, Indian Village, West Village, sort of a broader area, the Jefferson East CDC. Midtown Inc. is obviously the biggest one, but I think that they're all starting to work together and think about how to take things that have worked in one area, bring it to another. I mean, one of the things I would love to see is sort of a way to invest in sort of an ambassador in each of those CDCs towards the small business owners of those districts to sort of say, how do we help you?
Right.
You know, not just, oh, come to us if you have a problem, but like, we're actually going to be in your business, understanding what you need. If you're about to lose your lease, do we know where we can get you something else? You need to expand and grow.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of move and discussion about trying to do something that works with those. So I think that's the collaborative effort. I really love Food Lab Detroit, which is really a small business incubator for food entrepreneurs, which I think is critical because food is sort of the first entryway for immigrants and for people who are just starting to come up and make their way. You can take grandma's recipe and make it in your kitchen and start to turn it into something.
Right.
And Detroit is doing it differently than anywhere else in the country in terms of bringing together, you know, both farmers and access to good produce, but also low-cost kitchen space so that you can get started. So there's a lot of great things like that that are happening that aren't happening elsewhere in the country, and we should celebrate that Detroit's doing some things right.
Okay. Another thing that you described in your book was getting the finance.
Right.
Okay. And the struggle in financing the renovation, which... And you gave a true life explanation of that.
So, So I talk about the money pretty transparently in the book. And I did that for the reason that I think too often we talk about these things, but we are too embarrassed or too scared to put the actual dollar figures to it. And I think if we don't, nobody can really understand what it takes. So I laid our finances bare, which was interesting to talk to my husband about that in advance and say, okay, we're going to have to do this. But we bought a house. It's a 3,000 square foot house for $35,000, and we put $400,000 into it. We didn't expect to have to put $400,000 into it in the beginning, certainly. But it is a house in a neighborhood that is on the National Register of Historic Places.
Right.
We made a choice to do a historic restoration, not just a Home Depot special.
All right.
But there are not mortgages in Detroit. Unless it's a move-in ready house, which there's very limited stock of that,
yes.
You don't get a mortgage.
Right.
And you can understand why. It's not the banks just sort of saying, we don't want to help, but how do you write a mortgage or a construction loan on a house that's going to be worth less when it's finished than you have to put into it?
Right, right.
And that was our problem, is it cost us more to bring it back to life. And, you know, I would say at least $320,000 of that is in the walls, just rebuilding it inside. It's not like fancy Italian marble. But so that, I think, is the challenge of Detroit, is whether it's newcomers or people here trying to buy the housing stock that's been allowed to degrade so far.
Right.
And the cost of renovation is the same here as it is in Denver, as it is in Austin.
Yes.
And so these houses have to have a certain value to have banks want to lend on them. And that is the challenge. One of the things that's happening is, you know, the city has created a new construction loan program that's starting to roll out. So there's efforts to get around this, but that is one of the challenges to bringing Detroit back or giving people opportunity to invest in their city. Is it doesn't do anybody any good to be able to buy a $5,000 house if they can't get the money to actually make it livable.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I think that that is one of the uniqueness about the property that you receive, because in this day, it was a mansion or part of that, you know, upper class.
Yes, it was.
Environment. Okay. Which is kind of, which is some of the, I won't say schizophrenia.
Right. I mean, Detroit's a city that built the middle class. It's a city unlike others in that, you know, people had the expectation and the ability for everybody to pretty much have a single family home rather than the apartment buildings. And even sort of the middle class of its era had these large brick homes.
Yes.
And so we have amazing housing stock, which, you know, other cities don't have.
Yes, yes.
But that also being able to renovate them
is
a challenge.
I recall a friend of mine saying that Detroit is the only place where the poor ghetto have brick houses.
Okay. Right. And so, you know, we think about that, and who owns is going to change the future of the city. You talk about gentrification, you know, and just sort of rising prices, you look at a New York or a San Francisco, it's easy for gentrification to happen because it's a primarily more of a rental city than an owner city. And so in a renter city, you move on, the landlord can jack up the rent because there's suddenly demand, and it can go to hyper price quickly. But if you own, nobody can change those prices on you. You've got your property taxes and things to deal with.
Yes.
But even here in Michigan, it can't go up more than 3% a year.
Right.
So how we make sure that we take this housing stock and get people to be able to own it, get people who've lived here, making sure that, you know, if they want to, they can convert to ownership or get the ability to take, you know, and invest in the properties that they do own, because that's going to change the dialogue here about stability and who, you know, who we're helping, how we're growing and developing as a city. If those people who've always been here and those of us who are coming in are able to own and sort of figure out with our CDCs and our community groups and our block clubs what the vision is for our communities. We have some control over that through ownership.
Right.
And I think that's one of the challenges is making sure that it's not too much speculation, that it's not. And honestly, I'm concerned about my neighborhood. I have a very economically, racially diverse neighborhood. It's one of the things we love about it. But I also have a lot of neighbors who've been there for 50, 60 years. Their houses have been underwater. They've had no asset.
Right.
And suddenly, like, they need to go into assisted living, or somebody needs, you know, money for something, and their house is worth more than it ever has been. So that's a benefit to them that we've come in, fixed up this house, raised property values. But if everybody starts selling en masse, suddenly there's a huge turnover. And if we're at a place where only newcomers can afford to buy it, then that changes the dynamic of the neighborhood.
Right.
I don't know how you control that, but that's something that we're really thinking about is how do, and some of our neighbors who want to age in place in our neighborhood, the woman who lives behind me, Cynthia's, you know, 60, and she's, you know, got Parkinson's, and she wants to be able to stay in her house. So how as a community do we come together to make sure she's safe and secure? Are we making sure to shovel her snow? Are we taking her trash cans around? How are we texting her daily to make sure, like, we're thinking about that as a community? I don't know if that's happening in every neighborhood, but it's one of the things that made me fall in love with the West Village, is knowing that isn't even being thought about.
I think what I'm hearing is something that is, you're describing how the Detroit community is, how is impacting how it's occurring. But I think that is something that we're looking at across the board, because there was this writer, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Kimosaki.
I don't know the name, but I know the book.
All right. And one of his statements was that the middle class is toast. that there is no longer a middle class, or that the middle class is dying out and not to be replaced. Or, and if at this point, we don't know what it's going to be replaced with.
Right.
And I think when you are describing, you know, some of the changes and transitions that are going, it's not only something that's happening in Detroit, but it's happening, you know, worldwide.
Absolutely.
That type of thing. So you are, or we are, okay, not only, you know, your specific community, but no matter where anyone lives, this is a reality that we're facing. You know, we've just come out of the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And some people are saying, you know, are you sure?
Right. I mean, I look at it, and I was back home in Colorado this week for, you know, doing book tour and visiting family. And sort of watching around, and it's the exact same issues. In my small town of Fruta, Colorado, now has a sushi place. When I was growing up, it was completely boarded up and nobody was there. And,
right.
and what we call that sort of is the boutiquing of the American West. So you're taking these old sort of extraction economies mm-hmm. and towns that were set up around that, and now they've become tourism and travel-based economies. So now it's a big mountain biking town.
Right.
So Dad and I are having breakfast out at the sale barn, mm-hmm. where you actually bring cattle to set. Like, this is the old school. And then I'm having coffee in town,
mm-hmm.
and it's like mountain bikes and lattes, and it's just this really divergent expectations and experiences, income levels, what we think the world should be structured as. My grandmother is aging in her home way out in the country.
Mm-hmm.
She's unstable, but she wants to be able to age in place, so her
right.
neighbors are having the same conversation. So
right.
yeah, it's city, rural, you know, Detroit, Denver, you know, everybody's having the conversation.
Mm-hmm. In the introduction of your book, there's a quote from Leonard Elmore. Okay. Do you think that quote still applies to where you are now, or is it different?
I think it does.
Okay.
I still think it applies to Detroit.
Okay. And let me see if I can, while we're trying to, if I can pull up that quote. How so do you think it still applies?
Because I think, I mean, one of the things that attracted me about Detroit is that it is a city of people who have stayed, whether they had to or because they chose to, and they fight and they work. And
okay.
That's still true.
I'm going to pause. I want you to continue discussion, but mm-hmm. I wanted to read the quote to our audience. And the quote is, there are cities that get by on their good looks. Other offer climate and scenery, views of mountains or oceans, rock-bound or with palm trees. And there are cities like Detroit that have to work for a living. Okay.
Right.
And you were saying that, yes, the quote is still very applicable. And then you were saying because?
Because I think that Detroit is in this great place where it is. The name of the book is Detroit Hustle, because my dad always told me, kid, you got to hustle. You got to hustle harder than anyone else. And Detroit has hustle. Not hustler. I don't mean it in the negative connotation. But
they have those two.
Yeah, everywhere does. We all do. But everywhere I look, people are hustling. They've got their day job and a side job and their creative thing. Everybody is trying to figure out their life, their city, and sort of build something. It's not a city that's sort of relaxing on its laurels and being
right.
like, oh, we have palm trees, so everybody's going to come here. Detroiters just have to work, and they're
right.
okay with working. And I think that, you know, part of the book is, how does a girl from rural Colorado wind up in Detroit? Well, because the culture is almost the same. Like the
okay.
culture of work, the culture of family, the culture of community, the culture of being in a place that other people might overlook, but you know is the most amazing and beautiful.
Yeah, and you know, I think that that's also a kind of uniqueness about Detroit. Growing up, I did not consider Detroit as the Midwest, but we are, all right? We're the
yeah.
eastern portion of the Midwest, but we are Midwest. Colorado is kind of like the western portion of the Midwest.
Right.
All
and
right.
we don't consider ourselves Midwest either, but we're not coastal west
right.
either.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think that that is part of the Midwest heritage, if you will.
Well, and you mix it, and then you mix it with sort of the Southern. So I feel like Detroit's
yes.
not just Midwestern, it's Midwestern with a lot of overlay of Southern, which makes it
yes, yes. And that was
better.
That was the other point that I wanted to bring up, is that when I was growing up, when my parents first came to this area, everybody was relocating to Detroit. And then I'll stay in the late 50s or whatever, then people were born in Detroit. So now a lot of the script is flipping back, where now there are a number of people who are coming to invest, but they're not from Detroit, but they have an investment in Detroit.
Right.
Okay. And so we, because one of the things when I was reading that first quote from L. Elmore, I also remember something where it's saying that Detroit was the Paris of Midwest back when in the day of the Fords, that type of thing. So she has had many hats.
She has. So she was the Paris of the Midwest, and Denver was the queen city of the plains. So.
All right. Now, how long did it take you to write the book?
So that's actually funny. So when I got the book deal, the editor said, okay, so can you write it in 90 days?
Okay.
And like, I got hustle. My dad told, like, there was a door open. They wanted to give me a book deal. And I was like, of course I can write a book in 90 days. And then I went to the library and like got the book on how to write a book.
Okay.
But I actually, I did write the first half in about 90 days. And then changes of the publishing house, they moved my publication date back, thank goodness, because they realized it was important for the book to sort of span not just sort of going into bankruptcy, but the city exiting bankruptcy and the house being done. I needed to know what the end was. So in total, it took about a year.
That was what. And during that year, there's a lot of things evolving, wasn't it?
There were.
Okay. I didn't quite get to the end of it. At your ending, have you moved in at that point?
Or? Yes.
Okay. All right. So it's been how long since you ended the book to now?
So I actually finished the manuscript and the editing last October.
Okay. All right. So within that year, what has changed? And as reading your book, is that things were evolving. All right.
Right.
So what has evolved since you finished the book?
So certainly what has evolved since we finished the book is we were starting to talk about finances, you know, there's becoming new loan programs available. So people who are now embarking on what my husband and I did have some more options than we had. So that's good. More construction, more new restaurants, more sort of energy. And I think the conversation about how do we bring that out into the neighborhoods has changed. We're actually having that conversation. My neighborhood now all of a sudden, I mean, I just love my neighborhood and I'm biased, but I think that's one of the great things about Detroit is everybody would say my neighborhood is the best neighborhood.
Yes.
We now have Kraftwerk and Detroit Vegan Soul. We've got Sister Pie. We've got Parker Street Market. We have, you know, Bricks Wine Bar is coming. You know, we've got Heavyweight Cuts. And one of the things that I love is the diversity of ownership. So we've got Black and we've got white, male and female, Syrian, and almost everybody lives in the neighborhood.
Right.
And I think that is a very special thing. It's not just sort of people from, you know, outside of it, or they've come and chosen to live in the city, like Hugh, who owns Kraftwerk. He used to own Ronin up in the suburbs. He sold off his interest and his house and moved into the neighborhood to start Kraftwerk. And I just, it's got a real community feel, and that is a big change.
All right. Now, you are, you work with Cranes.
I did. I actually had to leave my job there to finish the book because my editor finally was like, you've got three months to put this together. And I could no longer juggle both, but I did. I covered the bankruptcy for Cranes.
Okay. All right. And then there was one of the discussions, are we AA after the bankruptcy?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the bankruptcy, you know, it's interesting for me. I have a degree in economics as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I feel like with the bankruptcy, it led us into a good place. That does not mean it was easy for everybody. I mean, we cannot take for granted the fact that the retirees still took a hit. I mean, there's just no way to ignore that.
Right.
But in terms of being able to reinvest in city services, just like a personal bankruptcy, if you don't have to pay creditors, suddenly you can afford to pay, pay the car, buy medicine and gas.
Right.
So I think that that's where we're at, is we're actually able to see some real investment in city services.
All right. Then there was the position of always having to defend Detroit. What's your take on that?
It's getting easier, if only because people don't come with quite the same assumptions anymore. Mm-hmm. Although I've been doing a radio tour, and so I just talked to somebody from Iowa this morning. You never know who you're talking to.
Right.
and having to sort of calibrate in the moment what their expectations are. And so sometimes I get the, oh, you're a great urban pioneer, congrats, and which takes me aback. And I first want to be like, no, that's not the conversation. But again, people don't know what they don't know. So right. having to talk to them at the level and get them even just to understand that, like, so many great things are happening here and there is so much wonderful, to convince them it's not, Detroit isn't just ruin porn.
You know, and I'm shaking my head, nodding my head, yes, because that was a little bit of how, I won't say your way of starting the book off was justified as you read the book, is that you almost have to give a person a life lesson, a life history lesson about not only you, but about the city, to give them a foundation for them to understand what you're talking about.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, it was actually when I was writing the book, one of the complicated things was, where was the beginning?
Mm-hmm.
Because even when you're writing a book, you write it in scenes and snippets, and it doesn't mean it's all going to, you know, go together just chronologically.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I started the book with just me in Detroit, there's no way I get around the perception of who I am now, which is you see me as newcomer, I'm white, you know, good jobs, middle class with access to resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I look like white gentrifier come to save Detroit. I mean, there's just no way not to see me that way. But if I was going to get people to take the book seriously, I also needed them to know my backstory of growing up really poor, of my parents not having anything. So, but if I just start with Fruta, people are picking up the book and going, wait, I thought I was reading about a house in Detroit. So it was very complicated trying to figure out how to thread that and give enough backstory so people would understand that I am more than what you might see right now. And this is a complicated past, as I may be perceived as gentrifier here, but my family's being gentrified out of Colorado. Mm-hmm. But also needing to give non-Detroiters sort of the what they're expecting for this book, too.
Not necessarily just non-Detroiters, Detroiters as well.
Absolutely.
Because I think that those who live here, some of them, and there was one person, oh, I think he even mentioned how there was a person who said he's lived here all his life, but then you really had to respond in a position of defending Detroit.
Right.
So it's not just the outsiders.
The insiders, too. I mean, one of, I had somebody in the book, I talk about it, somebody leave a voicemail basically saying he's had to live here all his life, get out while I can, you mm-hmm. know, and as soon as we have kids, we'll get out. My neighborhood is filled with kids right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kids in there in high school, new babies, so I think that is changing, and that's mm-hmm. going to be dependent on education.
Right.
We have to deal with that, you know, whether or not what Lansing just did is enough. I can't speak to it. I don't have education.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also, you know, had comments tell me I'm raping Detroit.
Okay.
And that one was hard, you know, because I don't know how to come at that one, because I know it's based on assumptions and perceptions. It was a house that had been abandoned. My neighbors are thrilled that we're doing it. I didn't push anybody out, but mm-hmm. certainly, you know, I recognize that that property values are going up because we did this and we mm-hmm. had the ability to do it.
Mm-hmm.
What nobody knows until they read the book is the only reason we were able to do it is because my parents divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was willing to lend me the little bit of money he got out of the settlement.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I had a trust fund I was sitting back on or could have called my dad at any other time in his life.
Right.
And my dad's so proud.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, for the first time in my life, I was able to help my daughter. I didn't get to help you go to college. You're the first one in our family to actually do it. I couldn't do that for you, kid.
Okay.
But finally, I can help my daughter. You know, I've paid him back. But he was like, this is, you know, a terrible, tragic thing in my life that I've lost my business. I've lost my wife. At least I can help my daughter with
mm-hmm.
it.
And I, that's where, now, your book is nonfiction, but is there another subcategory of how you would, that title, your it's almost like your book has a genre of its own.
I mean, you know, I think that might be true. It's been difficult for people to know how to sell it, because is it just a nonfiction book about Detroit?
Mm-hmm.
What are the memoir themes? But it's also sort of nonfiction about race and class and gentrification and history. So I think people have had a hard time figuring out how
mm-hmm.
to classify it, because it's none of it. Like Detroit, I hope to think it's also it was a complicated book.
Yes, complex. Yes, which was, and I keep on you going back to my kaleidoscope. I got a bit, okay. Instead of hopscotch, we'll say kaleidoscope.
Yeah,
okay.
Get that.
Because you have pockets mm-hmm. and areas, and I think you quite in the book, you describe the history of. so that where we are has as much to do with what was laid down because of, like you said, the unique is Detroit is an owner.
Right. It's more owner city than places like San Francisco.
Right, right. Which is distinctive for most cities. Mm-hmm. Okay. And as opposed to, you know, suburbs, and that distinctiveness. And so therefore you, the city attracts a certain type of person. Not everyone is going to have, there's an organization where they introduce people to upcoming businesses.
Okay.
All right. News. My mind escapes me, but it's each year. Mm-hmm. It was it's like a community tour of the up and coming businesses.
Okay.
In the Detroit area, which focuses coming from an entrepreneurial aspect, but with those businesses. Then they have employees, they have mm-hmm. investments. So the finances are, you know, everything is unique and distinctive.
One of the things I think is really distinct covering entrepreneurship is that Detroit is unlike any other city, and then it's trying to rebuild both ends of its entrepreneurship spectrum. Most cities are just focusing on high tech, high growth. How do we get sort of the new knowledge economy brought in? And Detroit and Michigan are focusing on that as well. We have the New Economy Initiative, which is investing over there.
Right.
Where we're unique is we're actually also taking the small business just as seriously and small businesses that have been in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So on the other end of the spectrum, the New Economy Initiative has been giving out $10,000 grants to 30 businesses a year
mm-hmm.
that have been around for at least 3 years and mm-hmm. saying, do you need a new truck? Because that's going to make deliveries possible so you
mm-hmm.
can grow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, spend it on that. So why do we do that? Well, if we just put high-tech, high-growth companies in and we get all of those workers and we want them to live in the city, they have to have businesses, retail corridors, you know, that they can shop at to make mm-hmm. the city attractive to them. If they do that, they can support these mom-and-pop businesses. Doing that, suddenly, you know, we get them connected and we create a circle. We create an ecosystem rather than just trying. You cannot build the retail side, the small business corridors, without people to actually patronize it.
Right.
And you can't have the high-tech, high-growth workers coming in if this doesn't exist. So unlike any other city,
mm-hmm.
we're like having to rebuild everything at the same time.
Right.
And we're interested not just in startups,
mm-hmm.
but we're interested in the bin-ups. We're right. interested in helping those that have stayed here and fought it out in the city.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know any other city in America that's doing it quite like that.
Right, right. Now, what about your neighbors, Detroit neighbors, Dearborn, which is where, you know, where we're mm-hmm. working. Going through, and I think this kind of like this uniqueness, distinctiveness is generic to this area. Do you see interaction or do you see similar kinds of things?
I don't see it, but I haven't sort of walked in those circles. My coverage was primarily Detroit. And mm-hmm. honestly, my life is just in Detroit. If I mm-hmm. have to cross 8 Mile, it's a very odd day. you know, so I know that that's out there. And I know like business leaders of Michigan and different organizations are having those conversations. I think we'll really see it play out with the regional transportation tax that's coming onto the ballot. And hopefully that means that we've got people working together and thinking about us as a region.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes people say to me, I'm just you know, oh, you're just trying to, you know, make Detroit Brooklyn. No, I am not. Actually, if I like Detroit for anything, because it reminds me of Denver.
Okay.
In, you know, the late 80s and the mm-hmm. early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, you know, just like Detroit, Denver had, you know, huge suburbs versus mm-hmm. city issues.
Mm-hmm.
No regional thinking.
Mm-hmm.
The arts and transportation brought that region together, and it's sort of taken off since then, with all of the downsides Detroit is sort of facing, thinking about too, of
right.
you know, price rising and gentrification.
Right.
But they figured out regionalism
mm-hmm.
and made it work for them. And I think that's where we're going to be at now, is that Detroit's really unique, but we're also surrounded by beautiful communities if we can figure out how to work together and
right.
and work as a region and have a 4.5 million person sort of firepower behind it, not
right.
just everybody infighting. And
okay.
I think that's the future, is how do we work as a region?
All right. What kind of economy do you think? Well, and I think you kind of like dubbed, you know, you were leading to that. Do you think it's still to be determined as to what the economy base is going
to
be?
So I think it's still to be determined. What I usually talk about is that we are starting to own mobility.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't just mean autonomous cars,
mm-hmm.
but the idea of how do we move people, services, and goods.
Mm-hmm.
We are, because of our physical location and our, you know, past history with the auto manufacturing, mm-hmm. we are primed to do that. We know supply chains like nobody else.
Okay.
So Google can start its car, you know, autonomous car in Silicon Valley, but when they actually need to build it and mm-hmm. actually figure things out, they come to us. So mm-hmm. I think we're going to get a lot of high-end manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
We're also getting a lot of design jobs.
All right.
Because we have so much history with design for the automobile. We've got a hotbed of both engineering and design, which most other places don't have.
Right.
But I also think it's really important to treat the trades
mm-hmm.
as skilled labor.
Okay.
And it's something I'm very passionate about in my book, is that we hired contractors who were amazing. And I mm-hmm. treated them like skilled men.
All right.
Who brought a craft to me. I was expecting good quality at a fair price, but if we continue to do a race to the bottom and expect everything in this country to be the cheapest,
mm-hmm.
we're biting off our nose to spite our face.
Right.
If we want good jobs that can build a middle class, sometimes those jobs don't include college. Sometimes they include trade schools.
Right.
My brother's a diesel mechanic.
Right.
If we pay them and treat them like skilled labor, those become jobs that are supporting the middle class, that create opportunities for people who may not be going into the high-tech, high-growth, knowledge-based
right.
economy.
Right.
We have to produce things,
mm-hmm.
not just think about things and not just based on tourism. And
right.
I think Detroit can do that. But we have to take it seriously. So I get a little bit of pushback sometimes about having, you know, the good privilege, which it is,
okay.
and the good fortune to hire contractors. But I will also say I hired contractors that live in the city,
right.
you know, Grandmont Rosedale.
Yes.
All of my supplies came from local businesses. My windows are from Kelly. My lumber is from Public Lumber. Like, I kept the money in the city,
right.
and that's really important to me, because that means those people, you know, I can look at Krista Safra, the owner of Public Lumber, and be like, I know that my business helped her continue to feed her family.
Okay.
That's about the economy we build.
Right. Okay. If there would be a sequel to your first book, is this your first book?
This is my first book. I hope there will be more.
Okay. All right. Would you be writing a sequel, or would it be a different experience?
I think it would be a different experience. Being home in Colorado this week and looking at my hometown, I think that the thread that runs through what I like to write about goes back to us and them,
mm-hmm.
who's a local,
mm-hmm.
and sort of gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing the change in my hometown just between the sale barn and the coffee shop.
Right.
And so the idea of the boutiquing of the American West and who's losing
right.
in the culture wars, just as one is watching their culture disappear.
Yes.
And what's coming in its place. It doesn't mm-hmm. mean one is bad and one is good, but sort of we're seeing that change. I think that's where I'm focusing on, in sort of rural poverty.
Okay. And when we first started out the interview, you were saying that your theme, now looking back, what do you think the theme of your book is?
So I realized the theme of my book is both home, sort of how do you build a home,
mm-hmm.
You know, physical home and sort of the, you know, conceptually idea of home, but also how do you go, you know, how do you go from being a New Yorker, for example,
right.
to being a new anything else?
How
do we build our communities, and how do you go to a new place
mm-hmm.
and integrate there
mm-hmm.
successfully?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we are a country that is more mobile than ever.
Right.
And so as people are picking up and looking at where they're going to go and where they, you know, what they want from their lives, often the conversation is about, well, it's cheaper in Detroit
mm-hmm.
or softer, better, warmer, whatever it is. How do you go to a place that's more
Okay.
But don't just expect it to be whatever you came from
All
with
right.
sunshine or came from, but cheaper.
Right.
How do you embrace the place that you're in?
All right. And if they want to contact you, how would they go about reading?
So you can find me on my website, which is amyheimerl.com.
Okay. And you're going to spell that out for us slowly.
Yes, I am. It's
okay.
AmyHai,
mm-hmm.
M as in Mary,
mm-hmm.
ERL,
mm-hmm.
.com.
Okay. All right. I really appreciate your sharing your book with us. And you kind of like with the theme. Is there anything that we haven't really touched about?
I don't think so. We've had a great wide-ranging conversation.
All right. Again, thank you very much. And this is Betty Daniels from Impact. Thank you for joining us. And look to see you on the fourth Tuesday of Impact again. Thank you very much. And goodbye.
Thank you.
Goes wherever you may go, old Saint Matilda, old Saint Matilda, you go, old Saint Matilda, with me.
but the streets aren't for dreaming, no. Manslaughter, dragnets, and the ghosts that sell memories, they want a piece of the action anyhow. Oh, old Sing Matilda, old Sing Matilda, you. Go, old Sing Matilda with me. And you can ask any sailor, and the keys from the jailer, and the old man in wheelchairs know that Matilda's the defendant. She killed about 100, and she follows wherever you may go. Old Sing Matilda.
WebAdvisor, a program allowing students and staff access to college-related information. Through WebAdvisor, you are able to register for classes, view grades, track financial aid, print class schedules, and much more. Log into WebAdvisor by going to my.hfcc.edu/webadvisor or from the homepage, hfcc.edu.
Hey, knucklehead, what are you doing?
Ah, just a
throwing away this old WHFR loyal listener guy?
Well, make sure you recycle it, lame brain.
I know.
Better yet, why not save a tree and sign up for the WHFR e-newsletter instead?
WHFR has an electronic newsletter?
Yeah, you just need to go to their website, Hey, pay attention when I'm talking to you. WHFR.FM and hit the sign-up link. It has all the same bells and whistles of the paper newsletter.
Really?
Yeah, it's the most up-to-date WHFR info sent right to your email box. You got one of those, don't you?
Yeah, I got three of them.
Ah, you wise guy. Think about it.
Yeah. No more running up to the record store to get my copy and saving me on gas, too. Info sent right to my email box. That makes me very happy.
Well, okay, Mr. Happy. Let's go to WHFR.FM right now and sign you up.
Yeah, let's go do it.
It's informative, quicker, and easier on the environment. It's the WHFR electronic newsletter. Visit our website, WHFR.FM, and sign up today.
Seems like newscasts only talk about the bad news. I invite you to tune in to Impact, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. I'm your host, Lynn, reminding you that Impact airs the second Tuesday of the month, 1 p.m. till 2 p.m. You'll learn about safe house programs, health concerns, local church projects, dealing with holiday grief, even news about pet adoption. So tune in on the second Tuesday of the month from 1 p.m. till 2 p.m. for Impact, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. Remember, the show is podcast. Just go to Tuesday Talk on the WHFR webpage. That's WHFR.FM.
This is Jeremy Porter from Jeremy Porter and the Tucos. You're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
The following show was pre-recorded. Guys and dolls, you're at the malt shop with Daddy G here on WHFR Dearborn. And we're going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the malt shop where the jukebox is playing and the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.